some people will argue like you, God couldn't take my soul and put it in a desk because for various different reasons, right? Maybe there's like an essential property of me that's like, you know, I can't exist in desks or something. Like I'm essentially a human being. And so my soul can take on a human form. What do you make of that type of argument? Or do you think that God could take my soul and put it in a desk? Hey, welcome back to another episode of Parker's Pensies. I'm your host, Parker Setacase, and this is a podcast where we explore all the deepest ideas in philosophy, theology, nature, and life. I love thinking about cool stuff, so come think with me. This episode is another very special one. I have with me Dr. Brian Cutter. He's Associate Professor of Philosophy at Notre Dame. And we're going to be talking about, we're going to be talking about whether it's possible for robots to have souls. We might get into some of his other works on the inconceivability argument against physicalism. And then, I don't know, I don't want to say too much because I don't know where this conversation is going to go, but it's going to be awesome. We fill mind. We're definitely going to get in on robot souls. I love that topic. And a lot of these guys on Facebook have been changing my mind on whether robots can have souls or not. So I'm very excited to jump in with Dr. Cutter here. Before I do, I want to thank everyone who's making this podcast happen over on Patreon. If you personally have benefited from this podcast, please consider becoming a Patreon patron. You can find the link in the description wherever you're getting this episode at. Another way to support the podcast, if you're watching on YouTube, is to give me a super thanks. And that's like you can buy me a cup of coffee or whatever, just to say thank you above and beyond, just to support the podcast. That would be huge as well. And then another really cool opportunity is to go to my merch store. Let's see if I can pull this up better. Okay, so my merchandise store, where I have lots of new designs. Chasten Hahn has been working with me, and just amazing, amazing stuff. We have the proper pronunciation of Pensées here for those who hate the way I say it. We also have the based version, Pensées, the way that American swine like me pronounce it. We got brain stash stickers, all sorts of cool stuff. So check out the merch store. The link is in the description again, wherever you're finding this. And you can support me and local artists like Chasten Hahn, who's awesome. So there's some ways to support it. But without further ado, let's bring in Dr. Cutter and let's get in on substance dualism, souls, and whether or not artificial intelligent robots could have them. Dr. Cutter, thanks so much for coming on the podcast, man.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
I've really been appreciating your work on Facebook over the years as I've seen you. And just recently you put like, this is like a journal article. It's really fantastic and really fascinating, but you just put it on Facebook for a lot of your philosopher friends to consider. And I'd been thinking about this as well. So I'm really excited to jump in on whether or not AI, whether you think, or we should think AIs can have souls. Before we did that though, I wanted to get a little bit of personal information on you. How did you get into philosophy in the first place? And then what made you want to become a professional philosopher?
Well, let's see. I mean, I've always been pretty philosophically minded from a very young age. I mean, I can remember as early as elementary school having kind of inchoate philosophical thoughts and gravitated towards philosophically minded people in high school. And yeah, so, you know, when I jumped into college, I was very eager to take philosophy classes. I had already read a little bit of philosophy, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, and some stuff by Daniel Dennett and Douglas Hofstadter that I really liked in high school. So I took some philosophy classes in college. I initially did not plan on majoring in philosophy, even though I knew I was interested in it, mainly just because I kind of had pegged philosophy as a kind of canonically impractical major. But then I found that I just loved the philosophy classes so much more than any of my other classes. And so I went ahead with it and loved it so much that I decided probably imprudently to go to grad school in philosophy. And things fortunately worked out on the job market. Here I am
today. I forgot, where did you do your dissertation at?
I went to University of Texas at Austin and worked with Michael Tye and Adam Pouts were my two co-advisors there.
Nice, man. That's awesome. What was the topic of your dissertation?
So it was about consciousness and let's see, I believe the title was sensory experience and sensible qualities, something along those lines. So it was about kind of the metaphysics of sensory consciousness and the metaphysics of sensible qualities, which are the kind of directly perceptible qualities presented to us in sensory experience.
Sounds awesome. And I would love to take a look at that sometime. I wonder, I forgot where Sainsbury's at, but is he at UT Austin?
Yeah, he's at UT, or at least he was when I was there. I believe he's still there.
Oh, cool. Love that guy. He's hopefully he's going to come on again soon.
Oh, great. And yeah.
This is so, I love it. It's so cool. But so you did your dissertation on like philosophy of mind type stuff. Why'd you pick mind when there's so many other things to be thinking about?
The mind is the most interesting thing in reality, is I guess the short answer. I mean, mind was also one of the big strengths of University of Texas at Austin, which was another factor, but that was also one of the reasons why I went there. I don't know. I mean, I guess I've always been very fascinated by really big picture metaphysical questions. And, you know, at various times in my life been drawn to materialist views, but also found that like consciousness was a big hurdle towards accepting materialist views. And since questions about the metaphysics of mind seem to be kind of the draw the key battle lines for broader metaphysical questions about the nature of all reality. I guess that's kind of why I was drawn into those sorts of questions.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I'm right there with you. I think that's totally right. That's huge. And then I guess before we get on substance dualism stuff, do you find yourself holding a particular view? Like, would you call yourself a substance dualist, or where are you at?
So I definitely reject materialist accounts of consciousness. Okay. I definitely accept some kind of dualism about consciousness, at least in the minimal sense that conscious properties, states, processes are distinct from, over and above, physical processes in the brain and that sort of thing. Okay. I'm somewhat more agnostic between kind of substance dualism and mere property dualism, but I lean at least relatively strongly towards substance dualism. Nice. Though I think the considerations that support at least a kind of property dualism, I find more decisive than the considerations that from there would lead one to opt for substance dualism over property dualism. But I do think that there's marginally better reason to accept substance dualism over a kind of mere property dualism.
Nice, man. I love it. It's a good start to the show here. Okay. Well, so in one of your Facebook posts here, you argued that we should have at least like a middling credence that a functionally human like AI would have an immaterial mind. First, I guess just for the listeners and maybe for me too, like what do you mean by middling credence? What should we take that to mean?
Yeah, so a middling credence means a credence that's not... So a credence is just kind of your level of confidence in a proposition. How likely is it that you think it's true? A middling credence is a level of confidence that's kind of vaguely in the middle, not really low, not really high. So
yeah.
You have a middling credence in something if you think it's not extremely likely to be correct and not extremely likely to be incorrect.
Okay.
And I believe the conclusion of the argument that I posted was that we should have at least a middling credence. I don't think I argue that we should have at most a middling credence, though I suppose I also think that that's true, that that's not something that I argued in that particular.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's fascinating.
I mean, my own level of confidence is very middling. I mean, it would be artificial to put precise numbers on it, but, you know, somewhere in the, you know, 20% to 80% range roughly seems reasonable to me.
Okay. Yeah. And again, that's for a functionally human-like AI.
That's right.
And then, so you give this just like two-step argument. And the one is that it's an analogous case if we met a alien. There we go. Jeez. If we met an alien that was functionally human-like and we could, you know, maybe even speak with it, or it had a translator or whatever, it looked like it was an intelligent being, then we would have reason to think, at least a middling credence, that it has an immaterial soul. And that would be like step two. Just, maybe I'll let you lay it out for us a little bit better than that.
So that it was meant to just be a kind of simple two-premise argument for the conclusion that we should have at least a middling credence that a functionally human-like AI would have an immaterial soul. First of all, this is all conditional upon the assumption that we ourselves have immaterial souls. Of course, that's controversial. A lot of people would reject that. Setting those issues aside right now, basically, I'm speaking to people who accept substance dualism or something like that about human persons, and then raising the question, how confident should we be that the same would be true about functionally human-like AI? Yeah, and so then, as you said, the first premise is, look, if we met seemingly intelligent aliens, extraterrestrial life forms that pass whatever behavioral tests you like for intelligence, maybe they have language and complex society and civilization and so on. But let's assume that in terms of their material constitution, they're very different from us. Maybe they're not carbon-based life forms. They have some like different kind of molecular constitution. Maybe they're made of green goo or whatever. The key point is that they behave and function in ways that kind of abstractly resemble human beings, but when it comes to their low-level material constitution, they're very different from us. And the claim is, if we met such aliens, we should have at least middling credence that they have immaterial souls, at least conditional upon the assumption that we do. And I believe in the post, I didn't really say anything to argue for this. I find in conversation that pretty much everyone wants to accept this claim. This just seems very intuitive and natural to a lot of people. So I think most of the action would be in the second premise. The second premise says, well, if that first claim is true, then we should also have at least middling credence that functionally human-like artificial intelligence has an immaterial soul. So functionally human-like means roughly, so first of all, it behaves in kind of human-like ways. It passes whatever behavioral tests you like for general intelligence. It can perform any behavioral task, at least at the human level. It can carry on conversations. It can fold laundry. It can play chess, at least at the human level, and so on for other tasks. And, you know, somewhat more specifically, if we look at its more detailed causal organization, let's just suppose that it resembles human beings at a kind of abstract level of causal organization. So you might have this if you created an AI that was implemented via a detailed simulation of a human brain. So maybe a large artificial network of neurons where the connections between neurons and the artificial neural network are somehow isomorphic to the connections between neurons in a human brain. So this would be this would be an artificial intelligence that is as human-like in abstract functional respects as it's possible to be, but still implemented on a physical computer. So the thought is, if if we accept soulhood in the alien case, we should accept AI and soulment, at least for these functionally human-like artificial intelligences. And the argument for that second premise is, well, prima facie, there's a very nice analogy between the alien case and the AI case. In both cases, they resemble us in kind of abstract behavioral and functional respects relevant to our mental lives, and differ from us at a kind of in terms of their low-level material constitution. And if you think that differences in low-level material constitution aren't enough to dismiss alien ensoulment, then you should also think that that's not a good reason to be dismissive of AI ensoulment. And so the challenge for people who do want to be dismissive of AI ensoulment, who are very confident that functionally human-like AIs would not have immaterial souls, is what's the relevant difference between aliens and between the alien case and the AI case?
Yeah. Yeah. And you give some of those differences. I want to talk about those, but real quick, I just wanted to, you said that most substance dualists ought to affirm one, or just will affirm one, or maybe from your own experience have. And I think that's because it mirrors the like a multiple realizability argument, like from Putnam, against the type, at least the type identity theorists, where it's like, look, you know, our dog has pain states. And even though it has different neural circuitry and, you know, maybe they don't have C fibers. Maybe we don't even have C fibers because everyone always points to C fibers, but who knows what the real mechanism is. But yeah, like an alien, that all this, the multiple realizability has shown, like, I think pretty strongly that type identity theories are false. And then token ones are kind of like a functionalist theory, though I know some token folks would say no. So you're just doing that same move, but for the substance dualist, and saying like, well, look, why wouldn't we think that if there was an alien? And I think there's a couple other objections that I want to deal with. Like some theological ones about like being image bearers of God type stuff that come from the theological circles. But first, maybe we could get in on yours. You say that two main ones: AI isn't alive, and then AI aren't AI are artifacts, and right, for some reason, being an artifact like precludes ensoulment. So what are these arguments? Like, well, yeah, can you flesh them out for us?
Yeah. So the challenge, as I said, for those who are dismissive of AI ensoulment is, point me to the relevant difference between the AI case and the alien case. And then, yeah, so here are two things that I often hear as candidate relevant differences. So one thing I sometimes hear as well, the key difference is that the alien is alive. They possess life, whereas the artificial intelligence, well, it's a mere machine. It is not a living thing. And then presumably the background idea here is something like, life is a precondition for ensoulment. Mm-hmm. Only living things are eligible for possessing souls. So there are a few reasons why I'm not really convinced by this particular response. So first of all, like, hey, I just don't see a ton of reason why we should accept that life is a precondition for possessing an immaterial soul. I mean, that could be right. I can't rule it out. I certainly can't rule it out conclusively. But I personally don't think that we have very strong reasons to accept that. So, you know, if we don't have strong reasons to accept that life is a necessary condition for ensoulment, then I think we just can't be dismissive of the hypothesis that a functionally human-like AI would have an immaterial soul. So that's the first thing. The second point is a little bit more subtle, but it's, well, I'm actually not totally convinced that an AI wouldn't be alive, right, at least in the sense relevant to this particular response. So it might help to distinguish two different views of life, a kind of reductive view and a non-reductive view. So according to the non-reductive view, which I take it is probably the dominant view among philosophers today, it's certainly the consensus view among naturalistically minded philosophers. According to the reductive view, to be alive is just a matter of performing sufficiently many of the physical functions and behaviors characteristic of paradigm cases of life. So being alive is not some extra special ingredient that some physical systems have. It's just a matter of doing things like reproducing, metabolizing, maintaining homeostasis, growing, things like this. So if you exhibit sufficiently many of the features and functions characteristic of paradigm cases of life, then you count as alive. That's just all there is to being alive, according to this kind of deflationary or reductive view. Now, if you have that kind of view, I think it's certainly questionable whether an AI would be alive. I mean, it has a functionally human-like AI may exhibit many of the features and functions characteristic of life. So it may engage in a kind of reproduction by kind of making copies of its own code. It may engage in a kind of like metabolic process. It's constantly maybe taking in energy and using that energy, you know, with different physical mechanisms than takes place in life. But there is a kind of metabolic process there. It may involve various kind of homeostatic control systems that are functionally analogous to those involved in living things. So there are at least like a number of kind of the characteristic features and functions of life may be present in the AI. So I would say it's at best a kind of verbal question whether the AI is alive. Like we could talk that way if we wanted to, or we could define life in a way that excludes the AI. But once you get to the point where you think like, well, it's just a kind of purely verbal or terminological or semantic question whether the AI is alive, then life sort of doesn't seem like a good candidate for being a necessary condition on ensoulment, because presumably it's not a merely verbal question whether the AI has a soul. So on the other hand, you might accept a kind of like a non-reductive, more metaphysically inflationary conception of life. So a lot of Aristotelians, I think, have this kind of conception of life. Some like vitalists, where being alive,
I was going to say vitalists,
kind of like élan vital, which is like a non-physical force that's responsible for the physical functions that we observe in living things. So that's another view you might have of life. But I guess I think if that's your view of life, you shouldn't be very confident that an AI lacks that either. Because after all, you know, these élan vitals or whatever kind of like non-physical ingredient is responsible for life, it's not the sort of thing that we can just directly observe. We can't just kind of peer in and check whether it's present. We presumably get at it by inference from observed behavior and functioning. But as we've seen, the AI exhibits a lot of the characteristic behaviors and functions associated with life. And now, like at this stage in the argument, someone can't just say, oh, no, because like there's some kind of like carbon specific signature for life, or, you know, so the physical signs or symptoms of the élan vital are something that like is specific to our like physical biochemistry or something like that. You can't really say that if you accept the first premise of the argument, because you've already granted that that an alien can be ensouled, where by stipulation, the alien has very different physical biochemistry. So I guess I just want to say, like, even if life in some sense is a precondition for ensoulment, it's not at all clear that that functionally human-like AI would not count as being alive in the relevant sense.
Yeah, and that first premise is so gold, because it's you could think of all sorts of different creatures, like a gas cloud, you know, it lights up or something when it's speaking to you. There's all sorts of amazing, really cool things you could do to look at that, or, you know, bring up like an octopi or something. An octopus, and like, or a cuttlefish, and how they, you know, communicate in all sorts of crazy weird ways, now just make it sentient in the same way we are. I love that. I think another thing about the life being a precondition, it seems like it kind of gets the substance dualist view backwards, because I think a lot of substance dualists want to say it's the soul that's doing the enlivening. Yeah. And when you die, the soul leaves the body. It'd be really weird to think that the soul is gone, but the body's still alive. And you might bring up a case of like a vegetative state or something. But in that case, you have like an artificial soul doing the enlivening, in that it's, you know, all the machines doing that, what the soul was supposed to do. And you don't have to go in for like a weird vitalist move, because the soul, you know, it's the soul that's doing it, not some, you know, vital force. unless you want to say that is a soul, but in that case, it's a little bit different than a spooky vital soul, vital source thing. So yeah, it just seems like the life as a precondition is getting it backwards. But maybe I'm wrong there. Do you know? Are there substance? Am I wrong here? Yeah. What do you think?
Well, no. So I think that's a good point. I mean, there of course is a tradition of, I mean, that within the Aristotelian tradition,
yeah,
the term soul is just used as whatever it is that's responsible for the life of living things, the first principle of life among those.
It's like the formal cause, right?
Yeah. So yeah, and so if that's how you're thinking of soul, then there's a kind of analytic connection between having a soul and being alive.
Right.
In which case, well, of course you can't be alive if you don't have a soul, because a soul is just kind of defined as whatever it is that's responsible for life.
Yeah.
But if that's how you're thinking of it, then, well, I guess it looks a little bit question begging to in the current context to assume that a soul is not present, because to assume that the AI is not alive, because
yeah,
if being alive for you just means having a soul, then, you know, that's just the question under consideration right now.
Right.
And, you know, so if you say that the thing is not alive, i.e. it doesn't have a soul, my question is like, okay, why think that? That's just exactly what we're arguing about. So that's the first thing to say there. I mean, my focus here has been, you know, within the Aristotelian tradition, people will still distinguish between souls of the kinds that maybe plants have and animals have, and immaterial souls of the kind that we have, where some of the operations of immaterial souls don't involve a bodily organ, and in that sense they're immaterial. I'm speaking about the immaterial kind. I'm interested in the question of whether, you know, functionally human-like AI would have souls of the kind that we do. And so if you think that that's the immaterial kind of soul that's relevantly different from plant souls or animal souls, that's the kind of soul under consideration here.
Okay. Yeah, that's really helpful. It's like whatever that thing is that is conscious, that is conscious, like in us, whatever that may be, like, because I'm glad you brought up the Aristotelians, because some of them might just go, oh no, false, because I think it's the intellect or something like that. And it's like, well, okay, if that's what you mean by it, that's what we're meaning by soul or mind, or, you know, different people have different conceptions, but like whatever is, I think whatever is experiencing the phenomenal, you know, qualia and stuff, right? Like that's what we're trying to pick out here. Isn't that right?
Yeah. So, certainly I think, well, if you accept substance dualism, you should accept that possessing a soul is probably the thing that's responsible for your capacity to experience qualia and maybe exhibit other mental properties like thought and free choice and other things like that. But so certainly there's a tight connection between your soul and your mental properties. There's a question as to whether the soul is the bearer of the mental qualities, or whether it's merely that by which you have the mental qualities. And I'm not really meaning to weigh in on that particular debate. So one alternative to the view that it's the soul that possesses the mental qualities is the idea that, well, what you are is not just the soul. It's kind of a composite of body and soul. And the soul is that in virtue of which you're capable of having these qualia and thoughts and feelings and free choices and things like that. But it would be incorrect to say that the soul is the bearer of those things. Okay. Yeah, I'm meaning to remain neutral on those sorts of issues.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, this is gold, man. Help me level up here. So then we have the natural kind, or sorry, the artifact worry. I was going to bring in natural kinds as an objection too. So I accidentally showed my hand there, but yeah, we have the artifact worry.
Yeah. So maybe I'll say a little bit about that. So one thing I've heard quite a bit in conversation from people who are totally dismissive of the idea that an AI would have an immaterial soul is this claim that, well, AI belong to the category of artifact, And artifacts are ineligible for ensoulment. They're not the right kind of entity to get a soul or to possess an immaterial soul. And I guess I'm not very convinced by this particular response. So first of all, I don't think that there's anything very metaphysically deep about the artifact non-artifact distinction. So I think it would be wrongheaded to give that distinction a ton of weight in our theorizing about the metaphysics of mind. One reason why I think that is that whether something is an artifact is largely a matter of its causal history. Something's an artifact when it's intentionally produced by people in the right kind of way. But it's very natural to think that whether some matter receives a soul is purely a matter of what's going on with that matter at that time, rather than its causal history, which could involve things, you know, very deep in the distant past. Here's an argument for that claim. Here's an argument for that claim. I think, you know, in principle, you know, maybe sometime down in the far future, we'll get to the point where we can create, kind of from scratch, building up molecule by molecule, individual human embryos or human fetuses. And if you think that human embryos have immaterial souls when they're kind of naturally produced in the normal way, then I think it's very plausible to think that if we made one of these from scratch, molecule by molecule, physically identical to a human embryo and kind of let it gestate in the normal way from there, that it also would have an immaterial soul. But notice that the embryo kind of created in the lab from scratch in the way I describe, I suppose that would count as an artifact because by hypothesis, it's human beings who are intentionally putting the parts together in a certain way. It certainly satisfies the normal historical criteria for artifacthood. But, you know, it would plausibly have an immaterial soul if we do. So that's an argument that whether something is an artifact cannot be the decisive factor as to whether it has an immaterial soul. Now you might say, well, no, I've got some more heavyweight notion of artifacthood such that the lab created fetus doesn't count as an artifact. But now I want to say, okay, well, if being an artifact is not just a matter of being intentionally constructed by people, then, and like some further condition is required, then A, I want to know what that further condition is. And B, I want to know like why you think the AI meets that further condition. Right, like maybe like if the lab created embryo doesn't count as an artifact, well, I don't know. It seems like totally open that maybe a functionally human-like AI wouldn't count as an artifact either.
Yeah, well, man, there's so many good things here to say. This is all gold. It seems like what's the precise thing that's being picked out? So if you're building up from scratch a human, and it does receive a soul, and it's not an artifact, I think maybe someone would say it's not an artifact because you're like tapping into the natural kind person, and maybe just by accident or whatever, you're making an isomorph of a human, but you don't know you can't give a precise point at which now it's a human being or anything like that. You just accidentally tapped into a natural kind. But if that's the case, why think that like the human being is the natural kind and not like an immaterial soulish thing, you know? Cause then it would move right over to the AI machine. Like you made this AI. Why aren't you just tapping into the exact same like soul making metaphysical principles or, you know, nomological principles, whatever, that give rise to soulish things? So like then you'd have to pick out the natural kind and say, no, we're picking out humans instead of ensouled things. So, you see what I'm like gesturing at there?
Yeah, so that makes sense. So yeah, one thing you might think is, okay, well, anything that belongs to a certain kind, a certain maybe natural kind, those are the things that get ensouled.
Yeah.
But then the question arises, as you're saying, okay, but how broad is that kind? If it's broad enough, it might include the AI. Yeah. One way of thinking about this is, well, the relevant kind is individuated by its kind of functional and behavioral propensities. So anything with kind of functional and behavioral propensities appropriate for expressing a mental life, you know, like does it naturally have the kind of behavioral powers of the kind that would be needed to express a mental life? Those are the things that are eligible for souls. That's the relevant natural kind. But if that's the relevant natural kind, then a functionally human-like AI would belong to the relevant kind. So there's certainly an epistemic possibility that the natural kind that makes something eligible for soulhood is for ensoulment is narrower than that and excludes the AI. Maybe it just includes Homo sapiens, or maybe it's a more disjunctive thing that would include Homo sapiens and the aliens, but somehow sidesteps the AI. I mean, that's certainly a possibility. That's why I'm not totally certain that a functionally human-like AI would have a soul. But I guess it just seems to me that there's no very strong reason to think that whatever kindhood requirements are at play here would exclude a functionally human-like AI.
Yeah, that's good. I really like this. This is really fascinating. I initially was so taken by arguments against functionalism that I thought, well, you know, just, yeah, functionalism's false, or it doesn't say enough about what consciousness is, so it's kind of bunk. And therefore, you know, robots can't think because they don't have souls. But, you know, folks like you and like Kenny Boyce on Facebook, of all places, have totally like opened my mind to this idea. I wonder, what about some people argue like God couldn't take my soul and put it in a desk because for various different reasons, right? Maybe there's like an essential property of me that's like, you know, I can't exist in desks or something. Like I'm essentially a human being. And so my soul can take on a human form. What do you make of that type of argument? Or do you think that God could take my soul and put it in a desk?
I don't have a strong opinion on that particular question. I guess I lean towards a no answer when it comes to your particular soul.
Yeah.
But I think it's important to distinguish the question of whether your or my particular soul could be joined to a desk or a rock or whatever, or an alien's body or a computer or what have you, and the question of whether those physical systems could be joined to some soul or other. So it might be the case that your soul has certain essential properties. It's essentially joined to a human body if it's joined to any material system at all.
Yeah.
But it doesn't follow from that that other material systems that aren't human bodies, you know, like can't get other kinds of souls. So, you know, in just the way that some people think that you couldn't have been the offspring of anyone other than your actual parents.
Yeah.
But it doesn't follow that people other than your actual parents can't have offsprings. I mean, they just won't be you.
Right.
So it could be that like my soul is essentially a soul of a human body. And so it couldn't be put in an alien body or in an AI physical system. But it could still be that those other material systems could be joined to other kinds of souls.
Okay. Yeah. This came up for me. I think planning gave like a conceivability type argument of saying like, I can conceive that God, that I could wake up as a cockroach. Does that ring any bells for you? Do you remember him?
Yeah,
saying that?
I know in his book, The Nature of Necessity, he considers the question of whether Socrates could have been an alligator.
Yeah, and that's right.
From what I recall, where he comes down on that question is in one sense, yes. And in another sense, no.
Okay.
Socrates' soul could have been joined to an alligator's body. So in that sense, Socrates could have been an alligator. But Socrates' soul couldn't have been an alligator body, because I think immaterial souls are essentially immaterial for planting. I think that he comes down with something, with something like that line. But yeah, from what I recall, I think Plantinga is open to the possibility, the metaphysical possibility of human souls being joined to non-human bodies, like alligator bodies or cockroach bodies or whatever. I guess my thought is there would be something inappropriate or unfitting about our souls being joined to cockroach bodies. Because our souls naturally have powers that could not be adequately expressed with cockroach brains and bodies and behavioral repertoires. But whether it's like metaphysically impossible for God to miraculously do that kind of thing, I guess that's less clear to me.
Okay. Yeah, that's good, man. I like it. So I just that comes up because I think of like this, you know, a top down versus a bottom up understanding of like ensoulment. Like top down being God, could God, you know, take my soul or take a soul and put it wherever he wants? Is a different question than like the AI question, which seems to be like baked into the concept of AI that us human beings are building something from the ground up, which becomes ensouled or not. So that bottom up one is what we're trying to pick out. But with the bottom up one comes like the natural order of things, right? Where it's like, there'd have to be some kind of mind making law or soul making laws in ensoulment principle that we'd have to like tap into, right? Like it would have to be part of nature, and there'd have to be souls, I don't know, like lined up or something, ready to go. Like I just think of like a vending machine, right? Like there's souls, and then this one is, you know, some principle is instantiated or level of complexity, and then a soul goes to it. So I guess just what would the story be? Because I think some people might say that, like, well, it's just so implausible that I can't even have a middling credence because there's no story on how ensoulment would take place or what the world would have to be like for this to happen.
Good. So that's a great question. So there's one way of taking that question where it's just an argument against substance dualism in general, even for us. But again, all this whole argument is conditional upon substance dualism being true for us. So let's grant that and first ask the analog of that question for the human case, and then just see how we could just say precisely the same thing for the AI case. So in the human case, here's just something that happens in reality. It's a wonderful thing and it happens and it's maybe very mysterious, but here's how it goes, assuming substance dualism. Human eggs get fertilized by human sperms, and you know, like let's assume ensoulment happens at conception. You could tell an analogous story if you accept delayed ensoulment. So matter gets configured in the form of a zygote, a fertilized egg, and that is either the cause or the occasion of a soul coming to be joined to this particular material system. Now, okay, how does that work? Well, there's one theory, kind of like emergentist dualism theory, that says that kind of latent in matter is the causal power, the natural power to generate immaterial souls when arranged in the right way, and including in the way that they matter gets arranged in a fertilized egg or in a later stage embryo or fetus or whatever you like. That's a view sometimes called emergentist dualism. Here's a non-emergentist dualist view that I am a little bit more, much more partial to. It's not so much that the matter itself naturally has the power to generate immaterial souls. Rather, the material configuration is something more like the occasion of God deciding to create an immaterial soul and join it to this material system. Think of what occasionalists say about all causal interactions in the material, in the natural world. That's what's true when it comes to the creation of souls and ensoulment, according to this picture. So on this picture, there's some kind of, you could call it a divine policy. God has a policy to the effect that when matter gets arranged in a certain way, I'm going to create an immaterial soul and join it to that material system. Now, like, in a, you know, we could ask like whether that's a kind of hard and fast policy or whether it admits of exceptions, but it's at least like a relatively hard and fast regularity, because we think that, you know, in just about every single case where a human is conceived, that gets a soul. We don't think it's like 30% of the time or 50%. We think like, you know, every human being has an immaterial soul. So there's some kind of like policy or deep regularity here. Okay, now let's consider the AI system. If you think that a functionally human-like AI would be ensouled, then you think that basically the same story goes there. God has a policy to the effect that when matter gets arranged in a certain way, and maybe that's a way where the physical system has what it takes in terms of its functional and behavioral repertoire to adequately express mentality.
Okay.
I don't know the story as to what exactly the conditions are, but there's some material conditions under which God has the policy of when those material conditions are met, God is going to create an immaterial soul and join it to that material system. And so for those who think that, for those who accept AI ensoulment, they just think, yeah, the material conditions are met in the case of a functionally human-like AI. So just to be clear here, the view would not be that we, in creating the AI, thereby create an immaterial soul. On this picture, we don't have the power to create an immaterial soul. We just have the power to move matter around and arrange it in different forms.
Yeah.
So what we do is move matter around in a certain way that is then the occasion for God to create an immaterial soul and join it to that bit of matter. In just the way that if we kind of made this kind of lab created embryo that I was describing earlier, we move atoms and molecules into a human embryo like shape. I think that an immaterial soul would then be joined to that embryonic body. It would not be strictly correct to say that we created the immaterial soul. What would be strictly correct is we were causally responsible for the material conditions, which were then the occasion for God to create the soul.
That's sweet. Well, so if I'm tracking you, I think if we're going with the cause route that assembling the molecules in a certain way is the cause, that's like, to me, that seems like the view tradition. Maybe it's not traditionism, because traditionism is like you get your soul from your father or your mother. But it's like that kind of view where it's like, yeah, we're causing that, we're bringing this about, and the occasion is like creationism, where it's like, no, you just brought about this situation, but God will, you know, he still has to act in a divine intervention-y type way of adding a soul. We don't create them, he adds them. But I forgot the language that you used. It was really good language. Like God has it's not a law,
I said policy.
Policy, yeah.
Yeah.
And the policy would be like analogous to a natural law. Like if there's just some natural law that he set up, and it's metaphysical law that if when these conditions, then a soul is created. That's just the analog is like, no, it's God's policy to do it. He could refrain from it. And maybe he just chooses not to or something.
Yeah. And I would be comfortable calling it a law. I think some people might be more squeamish about that description just because they think of laws as kind of summary descriptions of the natural causal powers of things. Mm-hmm. And according to this non-emergentist view, like nothing in nature has the causal power to generate an immaterial soul. So
yeah.
So, you know, if you think of laws as kind of descriptions of causal power, natural causal powers, that it wouldn't count as a law of nature. But if you just think of laws as something like descriptions of the robust regularities that we find to actually hold, then I think it's fine to call this a law. But, you know, putting this within a theistic context where just like any other law, it's kind of up to God's discretion whether he's going to like act on it in any particular case. He could miraculously decide to suspend the law and that sort of thing.
Yeah. So that's another like theological concern I hear from people when I'm talking about this, and they're like, you know, God just wouldn't allow that to happen. Or sometimes they even say like, God would like just like not let the world go on that long. I don't know why people go with that one, but it just seems like intuitive to them. Like, no, God, of course God wouldn't allow that. I don't know why. Maybe it's because like they think that we to have a conscious AI would be like an image bearer, and it's somehow inappropriate for us to create other image bearers. Have you heard this before, Brian?
Yeah. So I've heard arguments along these lines. I think there's there's two different ways of taking them, mm-hmm. one of which I find more plausible than the other. So one argument along these lines is it would be somehow a bad thing for us to create image bearers, assuming that possessing an immaterial soul has something to do with bearing the image of God. Right. And God wouldn't let this really bad thing happen. And so therefore, that's just not how the world is set up. I guess the reason I don't like that particular argument is it relies on the premise that God wouldn't allow some bad thing to happen. But evidently, God allows a lot of bad things to happen. Problem of evil, blah, blah, blah. So any argument of the form like X would be bad, therefore God wouldn't allow X to happen, I think we have empirical evidence against that line of thought. A different line of thought, which allows for the possibility of it, but just weighs in on the permissibility of doing so, would just say, well, somehow it would be inappropriate for us to create the material conditions, which are the occasion of something bearing the image of God. I was actually talking to Alexander Proust recently about these issues about AI and Solomon. He's a philosopher at Baylor University, and he was pushing the line that if a functionally human-like AI would have an immaterial soul, then it would be morally wrong for us to create such a being, because that being would be a person. The line of thought was something like that being would be a person, and persons are sacred, and where there's sacredness, there are restrictions on kind of what we can do surrounding those things. And in particular, there are moral limits on how we may permissibly create rational beings, rational persons. So he's speaking from a Catholic perspective, where those restrictions are, well, it's got to be through like natural sexual intercourse within the context of a marriage. Those are the only conditions by which we can create rational beings. And so if we created rational beings like, you know, at the Google DeepMind laboratory or whatever, like that would not be within the context under which we can permissibly create rational beings. So I think that argument is at least interesting. I mean, I think, sure. You know, like a lot of religious people, a lot of Christians think that there are limits on proper ways of bringing human beings into the world, and probably creating AI fall outside those limits. Now you could say that like, well, those are limits on how we can create human beings.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah.
Other persons. But I do think that Proust's thought is correct, that like it's a very morally weighty and serious thing to be just kind of willy-nilly creating persons. And we should be very careful about how to do that. And I guess I do find some plausibility in this idea that like you can't just kind of create something with that level of sacredness in a cavalier way or maybe not at all. So that's one kind of moral consideration against doing it. Again, that's an argument not that it won't happen, but that it shouldn't happen.
Yeah.
I think there are a number of other moral arguments that we shouldn't do it. You know, one is that creating AI, I mean, this is the kind of classic like Nick Bostrom style argument, generally intelligent artificial systems, whether they're ensouled or not, pose, you know, potentially an existential risk to the human race, because if they're much more intelligent than us, much more effective at pursuing their goals, if their goals are slightly misaligned to ours, that could be catastrophic with respect to human interests. And so that would be another kind of human-centered moral reason not to create these things. But there's also kind of like AI-centered reasons not to create these things, where like, I mean, like likely we're creating them in order to use them for some purpose, but now that starts to look a bit like enslavement, because we're just kind of using these things as tools. But if they have the kind of moral and metaphysical status of persons, that looks kind of questionable. So, you know, there's all sorts of tough questions about how we may permissibly treat AI if they really do have the moral and metaphysical status of persons. There's another interesting point that, actually, I think I got this from Alex Proust as well. So he pointed out that like when we when we go through processes of deep learning, so this is the process by which large artificial neural networks are trained.
Yeah.
Oftentimes that involves kind of like minimizing a loss function. So, you know, we feed it tons of data and we have it like perform in various ways, and it gets negative feedback when it's not performing correctly, or when it, you know, when it does a task incorrectly. If this thing is like actually conscious, then these negative reward signals are going to correspond presumably to subjective suffering, because, you know, they're kind of the rough functional analog of suffering in us. And so, like, we could just be exposing these beings to just absurd amounts of suffering in the process of training them. Yeah. I mean, especially that's true if you look at like the sheer amount of data that goes into training some of these artificial systems. Like it's vastly more data than human beings get within their learning process. You know, like we can, I mean, just because human beings like learn much more efficiently than at least current artificial.
Oh, okay. I was thinking maybe the reward would be more worth it because there's, you know, with more information in, maybe more output out, but you're saying we learn more efficiently. So maybe even for them to learn the same amount that we learned, they're experiencing way more trials or hardships or pain even.
Yeah. I mean, at least that's true for current AI systems. I mean, the amount of data that goes into like training these things and kind of calibrating the networks is just gigantic compared to anything that we ourselves get in the learning process.
Yeah.
Now, maybe that would be very different once we achieve something more like AGI.
I wonder if you could just run. I wonder if you could just run like a soul building. Yeah, theodicy there, and be like, well, like literally, you're literally building his soul.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you might be able to justify it because something maybe wonderful and splendid will come out of the process. But you know, I take it. Any time we're doing something that's going to lead to massive amounts of suffering in a rational being, that's a significant moral reason to not do that thing.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah, I wonder if there's like an antinatalist argument looming right here, you know, where it's like maybe you shouldn't bring kids in the universe then because of the amount of suffering. No, help me with that real quick. That's gross.
I mean of course there's classic antinatalist arguments that by bringing children into the world you're doing something that you can be pretty sure will result in at least some suffering in your children, and likely a lot, because a typical life contains a lot of suffering.
Right.
I think that's not a good enough reason to justify antinatalism. I mean, maybe if you had reason to think that your children's lives would be a kind of a bad thing on net, like it would involve more bad than good, taken all things considered, then that could be a good reason to choose not to have kids. But usually these antinatalist arguments don't rely on premises that strong. And I think, you know, in normal cases, claims like that would be very implausible.
Okay. That's good. That worried me for a second there. So This whole argument is, predicated on substance dualism, and some of the listeners are going, well, who cares? And so I was wondering if we could maybe go over one of your arguments for, at least an immaterial mind against physicalism. And that's your inconceivability argument against physicalism.
Sure.
Maybe briefly, could you lay out, as you do in the paper, what the conceivability argument is? And then we could talk about how yours is different.
Yeah, good. So the conceivability argument, the very well-known argument for against materialism, it can take different forms, but basically the idea is this. First of all, you can conceive of something physically just like me that lacks consciousness. Mm-hmm. Or that has different kinds of conscious experiences than I do. So most straightforwardly, we can conceive of zombies. So a zombie in the philosopher's sense is a being that's physically identical to, say, a conscious human being like you or I, but that lacks conscious experience altogether. So it doesn't have a first-person perspective on the world. It doesn't experience qualia, subjective experience, whatever you want to call it. This to me seems totally conceivable. There's no logical or rational contradiction in the idea of something being physically exactly like me down to the finest molecular detail, but lacking any conscious experience at all. So that's the first premise. And then the second premise of the conceivability argument is some principle to the effect that conceivability is a guide to possibility. So if you can conceive of something being the case, that's at least evidence that it's metaphysically possible. So I can conceive of a giraffe standing on top of a library. And so that's evidence that it's at least metaphysically possible for a giraffe to stand on top of a library. And, you know, the more clearly you can conceive of it without generating any internal contradictions, according to this line, the stronger reason you have to think that the thing you're conceiving of is metaphysically possible. Okay, so then from there you get that it's possible for something to be physically just like me while lacking consciousness. And then we're supposed to get to the conclusion that consciousness, therefore, is something over and above my physical processes. It's something over and above my physical makeup, my physical properties. Because if something could be physically just like me without being conscious, then it follows that my consciousness is something that goes over and above. It's something distinct from, something further than just what you can capture in a purely physical description of me or my brain.
Yeah.
That's the conceivability argument.
Okay. And I, if I'm remembering correctly from your paper, you're like, you're not super moved by the conceivability argument.
I'm not entirely convinced by it. I don't think it's a horrible argument. I mean, I think to make it good, you need to make a zillion qualifications that I haven't gotten into here. David Chalmers is the philosopher who's given the most sophisticated and compelling versions of the conceivability argument. His version uses a semantic framework that's called two-dimensional semantics. It gets a little bit technical, but it turns out that there are some pretty serious problems with the simple version that I just laid out, but that the most serious problems can kind of be patched up with the more sophisticated two-dimensional version of the argument. But yeah, I mean, that would be a whole complicated thing to get into. I guess my thought on the conceivability argument is that it's decent, but it's not totally convincing because mainly because it's not entirely clear that conceivability is a great guide to possibility.
Oh, great. Okay. That's what I was just going to ask you because, we already mentioned, it seems like a metaphysical impossibility that I could, it's been claimed that it's a metaphysical impossibility that I could have different parents. But it seems like I could conceive of that. And so I always have a hard time with like conceivability and metaphysical possibilities when it comes to like, I don't know, even like logical possibilities. I don't think I can conceive of a square circle, but I don't know that no one else could, you know, and maybe that just, so yeah, I just wonder about like metaphysical possibilities and conceivability. And how good it is a guide for those.
Yeah. So the case you mentioned, well, yeah, I can certainly conceive of having different parents. It might be an epistemic possibility for me that I have different parents than I initially believed that I did. That seems like a coherent hypothesis that doesn't involve any internal contradictions. So, but you know, if you accept essentiality of origins, you think that's impossible. So, right. So yeah, that's a kind of classic kind of alleged counterexample to the idea that conceivability entails possibility. Mm-hmm. Another counterexample along these lines is it's conceivable that water should turn out to be something other than H2O.
Yeah, H3O or something.
H3O or XYZ or whatever. But, you know, the standard view is that it's metaphysically necessary that water is H2O. So here it looks like we have something that's conceivable, water not being H2O. But not possible. So again, counterexample to the idea that conceivability entails possibility. I mentioned a minute ago that the more sophisticated versions of the conceivability argument, well, that there are more sophisticated versions of the conceivability argument. And without getting into the details, they put forward kind of restricted conceivability entails possibility principles. They say, well, conceivability entails possibility, at least in this range of cases. And then it turns out that that restriction is spelled out in a way that that excludes the kinds of cases that you're worried about.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Out of origins, water is H2O, and so on.
Okay.
But exactly how to lay that out is a little bit tricky. I can say for those who have the relevant conceptual background, usually the principle is something like, if something is conceivable and it's formulated in purely non-twin earthable terms, then it's possible. And if you don't know what non-twin earthable means, that's probably...
They should. We've talked about twin earth quite a bit. So yeah.
And then it turns out, like, when I formulate the hypothesis that I could have been born with different parents, then the twin earthable term there will be I. And when I consider water is not H2O, then the twin earthable term there is water. And so that's not covered by the relevant principle. But then it's going to turn out that, you know, terms like consciousness and terms for the basic physical properties, those aren't going to be twin earthable. And so the argument's going to go through under this restricted principle.
Oh, nice. Okay. Yeah. So that's really cool. I'll have to check out Chalmers' stuff more on that.
Yeah. By the way, I'll just say, kind of going back to our earlier conversation, Chalmers is a great person to read on the issue of AI consciousness. He's not really a substance dualist, but he accepts he leans towards a kind of property dualism about consciousness. And he also accepts the view that a functionally human-like AI would be conscious. And so, like, if you look at his book, The Conscious Mind, he's got a chapter, I think it's called Strong Artificial Intelligence, where he kind of lays out the case very clearly for this, and also argues persuasively that the question of materialism about consciousness is just completely independent of the question of whether an AI would be conscious. And so I think he's definitely right about that.
Yeah. I think I remember somewhere him saying, like, he splits his credences between, like, was it panpsychism and dualism or something like that?
So I think he's, you know, he's got some credence in property dualism, some credence in Russellian panpsychism, also Russellian panprotopsychism.
Until he watches this podcast, and then, you know, he's going to get your inconceivably argument, and we'll bring him over to. Yeah, that'll be good.
That's it.
Well, so I'm assuming, like, and I guess I've read your paper too here, but inconceivability is stronger than conceivability.
Well, inconceivability is just the negation of, the inconceivability argument is. So what I do in the paper is put forward an inconceivability argument against materialism that is structurally kind of similar to the conceivability argument. But then I argue that it's a better argument in the sense that, like, anyone who accepts the conceivability argument is going to have to accept my inconceivability argument, but the converse doesn't hold. You could be convinced by my inconceivability argument while still having significant reservations towards the conceivability argument, which is kind of where I stand.
Yeah. Dr. Cutter here, I'm tweaking out because my battery's low, but my charger's right there. So I just have to step off real quick.
Totally.
Okay. Yeah, that was really freaking me out. Okay. So I have I just grabbed some premises here, in case they're not on top of your head, but you said, hopefully this isn't too hard on a podcast, but we'll let phi stand for an arbitrary collection of physical truths, and we'll let Q stand for some phenomenal truth. And so then, you know, a first approximation of the inconceivability argument is one, it is inconceivable that Q holds wholly in virtue of phi. If it is inconceivable that Q holds wholly in virtue of phi, then it is not the case that Q holds wholly in virtue of phi. If Q doesn't hold wholly in virtue of any collection of physical truths, then physicalism is false. Therefore, physicalism is false. Yeah, let's talk about that.
So maybe just kind of less formally, more intuitively go through the premises. So the thought is, look, it's we can't even conceive of having conscious experience purely in virtue of some collection of physical facts. Like, it's not even coherently conceivable that I could have a sharp stinging pain or a vivid experience of pink purely in virtue of the motions of colorless insentient atoms. That's not something we can kind of rationally get a grip on, in the way that I can rationally get a grip on the idea of like a traffic jam occurring in virtue of the behaviors of a bunch of individual cars at the lower level. Oh, okay, yeah. So that's the first claim. And so that's a kind of inconceivability premise instead of a conceivability premise. And then the second premise of the inconceivability argument is a claim to the effect that inconceivability is a guide to falsity. So if something is kind of in principle inconceivable, like you can't get a rational handle on what it would be for that to be the case, then that's at least evidence that it's not in fact the case. So here, this is kind of mirroring the conceivability as a guide to possibility principle. My principle is inconceivability as a guide to falsity. And then from here, you can do a little bit of logical wiggling around to get to the conclusion that, okay, so facts about conscious experience are not fully grounded in any set of purely physical facts, given those two premises. Yeah,
that's really helpful. One seems like, to me, I'm like, I agree. It seems so strong. Like, how would someone argue against that? Like, would a panpsychist be like, well, no, if every little tiny molecule, you know, is conscious, it would. Help me out with it again. It's how would we argue against it, I guess?
Oh, good. So the standard panpsychist view is not meant to be targeted by this argument. So The panpsychist is on my team, at least the standard form, standard versions of panpsychism, at least with respect to this particular argument. So standard forms of panpsychism will say that consciousness is fundamental. It doesn't hold in virtue of anything more basic. It's one of the fundamental ingredients of reality. And then they argue that, well, you know, usually when we have fundamentality, we have ubiquity. So, you know, like mass is fundamental and it's all over the place. And so similarly, if we think that consciousness is fundamental, we should think that consciousness is all over the place, even in very simple physical systems. But, I disagree with that last point. But on the point that consciousness is fundamental, it does not exist in virtue of anything more basic. It's just a rock bottom primitive ingredient of reality. That's basically just the conclusion of my argument, at any rate, my conclusion is, well, it's related to that. But I mean, so that's my view. So that's something that like the dualist and the panpsychist agree on that point. Consciousness is fundamental. The main thing they disagree about is how widespread consciousness is in nature. But that's just not.
Oh yeah, okay. I'm always confused on like whether panpsychism like is a form of like property dualism or not, because, you know, a lot of times, at least like prominent proponents like Philip Goff will say, physics tells us what physical things do, but consciousness is what they are. And so it seems like you do get, you know, phi and q being identified there, or it's like the physical facts just they are phenomenal facts.
Yeah, so that would be a view in which it's kind of like consciousness is the inner nature of the physical. So physics and other sciences only tell us the kind of abstract structural description of reality, but it doesn't tell us what intrinsically realizes that structural description. And then the claim from people like Goff is it's consciousness. Consciousness is like the stuffing for matter, the intrinsic nature of matter. So that's a view that's not really my view, but it's also a view that I'm not targeting in this particular paper. Okay. So I say at some point, I think early on in the paper, that we can distinguish between so-called Russellian and standard forms of materialism, where the view I just described, which is the Philip Goff view and often formulated in terms as a panpsychist view, is the kind of Russellian version of materialism. Sometimes it's called Russellian physicalism. Sometimes it's called Russellian monism. Yeah. you could argue that that's a form of materialism, but it's not the form of materialism. It's at least a kind of non-standard form of materialism. And what I make clear in the paper is that's not the kind of materialism that I'm targeting in this paper, precisely because it agrees that consciousness is fundamental. It doesn't hold in terms of any more basic facts. What I'm targeting is the view that consciousness does hold in virtue of more basic facts that themselves do not involve consciousness. Facts like mere motion of matter or the shapes of material parts or the mechanical interactions among components in your brain, things like that. Facts that don't intrinsically involve consciousness, according to standard forms of materialism, are fully responsible for grounding the existence of consciousness at the higher level. That's the view that I'm targeting.
Okay. Okay. So when you, I take it that like a physicalist would deny one and say, well, it is conceivable that, you know, phenomenal facts hold in virtue of physical facts.
So, I mean, there are two key premises. I think either is just as eligible for rejection on the part of the materialist. I don't know if the first premise is going to be their more natural option. I mean, of course it is, you know, it's an option for them to say that it's conceivable that phenomenal facts hold purely in virtue of physical facts. But I, you know, so I argue against that in the paper.
Yeah.
One thing maybe worth noting here is that the kind of conceivability I have in mind is, this is what David Chalmers calls positive conceivability, as distinct from negative conceivability. So negative conceivability is just like when you can't rule something out a priori, then it's conceivable in the negative sense. So I'm not talking about negative conceivability. Maybe materialism is negatively conceivable. Positive conceivability is when you can kind of form a clear, distinct, positive conception of a situation in which that proposition holds. So roughly, it's like, can you clearly imagine that situation holding? As opposed to thinking like, oh, maybe it could hold, I can't rule it out. That's what positive conceivability is.
Okay.
And, you know, I think you can, well, it, yeah, I go through a number of arguments in the paper that like actually like positive conceivability does not hold. It's not positively conceivable that any purely phenomenal state holds in virtue of purely physical states. But the argument for that is somewhat involved. But I think there's certainly a lot of people are struck by this intuition, and like Leibniz's mill might be taken as a version of this intuition that like, you know, if you imagine going inside the brain and perceiving its purely physical operations, it's not even conceivable that like a vivid perception of pink could be wholly constituted by motions of mechanical objects pushing against each other. Like for some reason, many people have the intuition that we just can't even get a rational handle on like what that would mean. I mean, certainly like, you know, physical stuff might cause a distinct phenomenal state. That doesn't seem particularly hard to get a handle on. But the idea that there's nothing more to a vivid experience of pink than just colorless, insentient things bumping against each other, that's a lot of people, including myself, get a kind of rational block there. Like that's not even clearly coherently conceivable.
Yeah, that's really good. So I'm trying to think, like I just had a conversation with Graham Oppie and Michael Humer, and Oppie went in for like scales instead of levels of emergence and stuff. So like, you know, so I would imagine he might say something, and he is an identity theorist, which I thought was nuts, but he's Australian and all this
identity theorist.
Well, he didn't want to say that. He wanted to, I think he what kind was he? I think he went in for like the same view as Lewis, which I thought was kind of like a type.
Lewis is a type identity theorist, yeah.
Yeah. And so if he said something like in scales, I think of like zooming in on your phone or something. Like you're viewing at different scales. So What if an identity theorist says, like, yeah, okay, if you're zooming all the way in at the particle level or superstrings, whatever, there's no color there. But that's the wrong scale because we don't observe things at that level. We're all the way zoomed out at the human scale, you know, the manifest image scale, and there we do perceive colors or however they would say, right? Because it depends on, you know, are there colors or we just. So yeah, what do you make about that? That someone might say, well, you're talking about the wrong scale of things.
Yeah, so that's a great question. I guess I would say there are a lot of cases in which behavior at a higher scale is grounded in behavior of among things at a lower scale, where it's totally intelligible and clearly conceivable how it is that behavior at the lower scale gives rise to, grounds the relevant behavior at the higher scale. So I don't know, one kind of simplistic example would just be like a traffic jam. So maybe you start zoomed out, you see this traffic jam on I-5, and you wonder, like, what lower level facts are constitutively responsible for this traffic jam? And you kind of zoom in and you see this individual car coming to a halt, causing this individual car coming to a halt, and so on. And you can kind of like zoom in and zoom out, and it's just totally clear. Oh, like, here's how that high level thing gets grounded in the individual behaviors of individual cars. And if we wanted to, we could kind of go to a lower level. Like, why is this car coming to a halt? Well, because this constituent atom is coming to a halt, and this constituent atom is we with our finite minds might have a hard time kind of keeping it all in mind, but it's the kind of thing that you can totally see how, like, an idealized Laplacian intelligence.
Yeah, I was going to say, Laplace's demon could get it.
Yeah, like, just a completely transparent vision of, like, how it is that traffic jam, this high-scale, high-level phenomenon, emerges in virtue of the behaviors of individual cars and how that emerges from the behaviors of individual molecules and so on.
Yeah.
And my claim, and I, you know, I'm not idiosyncratic in this intuition, is that the emergence of consciousness from physical movements of atoms and neurons firing and this and that, it's just nothing at all like that. It's not at all intelligible in the same way how a vivid experience of pink or how a rational thought emerges from atoms banging into each other or patterns of neurons firing. I mean, so this is a pretty core, I think, bedrock intuition. I think, it's an intuition that divides people, not everyone agrees with it, but it's not at all idiosyncratic. I think a lot of people are at least initially struck by this kind of intuition, even if they kind of want to convince themselves out of it at the end of the day.
Yeah. Well, and I love this because I think of like Lewis's argument from reason, C.S. Lewis's. Sorry, there's so many Lewis's in philosophy and philosophy of religion. But yeah, it kind of depends on a similar rational thought not being reducible to physics, and you're getting in on phenomenal states, you know, and like quality and stuff. Sorry, my puppy was grabbing my cord, so he always makes an appearance here. So I love it. I think I'm just thinking of where I hate getting out over my skis, and I want to use your argument. So I'm trying to think like where it would be vulnerable. I don't want to just pull this out in the wild and then get hammered because I'm going to have to study more and learn it more and read your paper more. But where do you think it's most susceptible? Do you think it would be two then?
If I were a materialist and I wanted to find the most plausible way of rejecting the argument, I think I would reject the second premise, the one that says that if something is inconceivable, then that's a reason to think that it's false. Or I guess I could even accept that and say, but it's not a conclusive reason. I think the most plausible thing to say in response is, well, yeah, typically inconceivability is a guide to falsity. If something is in principle inconceivable, that's some reason to think that it's false. But it's not conclusive reason. And in this particular case, we just have countervailing reasons on the other side that are strong enough. And then I would wheel out the kind of standard battery of arguments for materialism and say, like, yeah, those just kind of defeat whatever prima facie evidence we had against materialism provided by the argument. Yeah. You know, arguments about mental causation and Occam's razor and all the standard things. And to that, I say, like, that's a totally reasonable response. I mean, I never thought this argument or any other particular argument was going to give like a conclusive slam dunk, like final blow to materialism. Right. That's just not the way philosophy works. Of course, if you want to form a responsible opinion on something like materialism, it's going to be a matter of the total balance of considerations on both sides. And there's going to be just like a lot of lines of argument and evidence that you're just going to have to kind of weigh in the balance. And that, I mean, that's just the kind of like inescapably holistic nature of philosophy and you know, like any particular argument shouldn't have the ambitions of kind of taking you all the way, at least with something as like fundamental and controversial as like whether materialism is the correct metaphysical picture of the world.
Yeah, we got to compare the theories, as Dr. Oppy often says.
I agree.
This is awesome. I don't think we're going to have time to get into the psychophysical harmony, but I just wanted to say that I talk with a lot of philosophers, and many point to this paper by you and Dustin Crummett as like one of the best arguments for theism out right now. And it's really intriguing and interesting. So just want to pass that along, man. Like, people love this paper. It's fantastic. Okay. Yeah.
Good. Well, I hope more people will read it. I had a fun time writing it with Dustin. Dustin is an awesome philosopher. I think you had Dustin on recently.
Yeah,
right?
Earlier this week. Yeah. Okay. It's been a mind heavy week for me. Okay, I also had Kenny Boyce to talk about this as well. So it's
great.
It's been a long week of mind stuff, which is fun.
All right.
Yeah. Brian, where can people find you? Where can they find more of your work?
Let's see. I've got a website. It's a Google site. If you Google me, I'm sure it'll turn up. Or you can get to it via the Notre Dame Philosophy Department page by clicking on my name. I also have a Phil People profile, for those who know about Phil People, that has, I think, all of my publications on there. So those would be the best places. And also just kind of feel free to email me. My email address is on my website. If you want to correspond about anything or have questions, happy to correspond.
Awesome. Yeah. I'll put those links in the description wherever people are getting this, you can find those links as well. So thanks again, Brian. This has been huge, man. It was just like a Facebook post, but it's really good thoughts and helped me like level up on some stuff. So I seriously appreciate all your time and your work. And I'm going to be diving in on much more of your papers, because they're just so, so fascinating. So thanks for all you do. And thanks for giving me your time today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Have a good one.
All right, folks, this has been Parker's Penses. And as always, all glory to God.